Hey, college football fans. This podcast is brought to you by Citi. And whether it's football or finance, teamwork matters, which is why Citi is proud to bring you college football's finest. The 2010 Rose Bowl game presented by Citi. This is the ESPNU College Football Podcast.
College Football Podcast.
Your host today, Ivan Maisel.
Hello and welcome to the ESPNU College Football Podcast. It's Monday, December 28th. And we here at ESPN bring you only the top experts in college football. And until they get here, this is Ivan Maisel, senior writer, along with...
That was funny. I'm like stunned that you were funny. This is Gene Wojciechowski with senior national columnist with ESPN.com.
Gene, I have an announcement to make. Because of health reasons, I've decided to resign from the podcast.
Is there anything I can do to convince you to come back?
Well, you know, the spirited tone of your voice, I think I will. I'm just going to take a leave of absence.
Well, now we got to be careful here because we're kidding a little bit.
Yes.
But we are speaking of the Urban Meyer Florida situation and what a bizarre 24 to 48 hours that was, wasn't it?
It was not a, yes, it made for an interesting Christmas weekend. Out of the blue, the news breaks Saturday night that Urban Meyer has decided to forego coaching to get healthy. And then, as an entire, at least orange and blue nation went into mourning, he goes to practice Sunday at the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans, and enjoys practice so much and in the spirited practice, as he described it, that he decided that he's going to come back. He's going to take a leave of absence, and he believes that he will be there coaching in September, was the way he put it, which still leaves the door cracked a little bit, I think.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's, we're talking, we still don't know exactly what's going to happen, and I'm not sure that he does.
No, and that's, to me, that's the whole key to it. It doesn't sound as if he's 100% convinced in any direction. He has no roadmap to where he really wants to go. I mean, what happens if he has a bad practice? What happens if he gets those headaches again or another shortness of breath or some sort of condition or moment where his health, is an issue again? Then what? I think the problem with this whole thing is you either do it and don't look back, or I think this is a bit of a mistake to sort of do a reversal. I mean, I think you go with your heart. Your first instinct is probably right, and Urban Meyer's first instinct was to walk away from the game right now and get his health in order and then reassess. And if... it's his decision, his life, but it just kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit that he's done this reversal so quickly.
I just wonder what
was happening behind the scenes to make him change his mind like this.
You know, I'm thinking of the story Pete Thamel wrote in the New York Times Sunday. He got Urban on the phone late Saturday night, was the way he described it, and Meyer, with these just wonderfully poignant quotes about from his daughters saying that they were so thrilled that they had their daddy back, and describing just the awful paces he had put himself through in the course of what has really been a nearly unprecedented run at Florida, but that he lost a tremendous amount of weight in the 10 days surrounding the SEC championship game. He had just terrific chest pains the morning after the game. And you think this is a guy that clearly needs to back away for his family, with all these reasons that he explained to Pete. And then all of a sudden he goes to practice and changes his mind.
Yeah, and it is a strange situation. I mean, he is not the first coach who has changed his mind about something as critical as this. You know, it's a different sport, but Mike Krzyzewski at Duke basically had to take off a season because of physical and mental related issues. I mean, he would just, he was absolutely spent. I mean, there was nothing there. And Urban Meyer, to me, sounds, while the exact medical conditions were different, just the stress of being the guy at the university of the program in the sport, it wears you down. And we've been around Urban Meyer in different situations, and it's hard. It would be hard to think of another coach who, I don't want to say wound tighter, Ivan, but certainly, you know, he had matches lit at both ends of the candle, and like a lot of coaches. But he had this intensity, and he does have this intensity to him that is different. And,
oh, it is.
And it doesn't surprise me. It really, when I first heard the news, Ivan, I don't know what you thought, when I first heard the news, and I just heard he was resigning, my first instinct was he's going to the NFL. My second thought was this has to be health-related. And it was, and I'm not going to second-guess the guy, but... Wow, if you make that decision, and Jeremy Foley had said what? That they had been talking about this for a week prior to the announcement, correct?
Yes.
So you've given it a lot of thought to do this sort of reversal. Just, I don't know, it's just something, it doesn't feel right to me.
Well, and I think Krzyzewski is a great comparison to make, and I'm annoyed that I didn't think of him, but... you know, you've been dealing with him lately, and it's good. But what it makes me think is that year that he took off at Duke, which I think was 95. I know it was in the mid 90s. It was just a terrible year for Duke basketball, and you know, I think Meyer, by doing what he did, at least assuming that he coaches. You know, I'm just curious what happens with recruiting. Do recruits back off? Did by him doing this, did he feel like he saved recruiting? You know, there's so many things that figure into this, and I guess we, you know, there's one of those things you just have to be patient and let it unfold and see what happens.
Well, it was the 1994-95 season. You got it right, and Duke went from being in the Final Four in 93-94. And they lost in the final to going to 13-18 and 2-14 in the ACC. And Krzyzewski and Pete Godette shared the head coaching duties. And it was an unbelievably weird year for Duke basketball. But I do know this, when Mike Krzyzewski came back from that sort of, you know, health sabbatical, things were different. He wasn't as accessible as he had been in the past. He said no more often. Him and his wife Mickey and their family sort of redefined how he would do his job. And I think that sounds like something Urban Meyer probably needs to think about, and I'm sure has, how he will redefine the way he does his job. And he's going to have to make changes, obviously, it sounds like. Will that mean that the program won't be as good? Well, who knows? It depends on those changes. But I don't know. I really have mixed feelings about this. I applaud him for having the width and the breadth of the feelings that he has for that university, and saying, you know what, I'm not going to walk away from it. I'm going to try to get myself fixed and come back and you know, do my job as well as I can do it. But to me, if you're having those sort of symptoms and you have those sort of worries and you have been thinking about it for a while, maybe his first instinct was the right one.
Well, and you can make the case, and in fact I would say it, the fact is, you know, Krzyzewski has had a great career since he returned, but it has not burned quite as brightly as he did before he left. You know, and it's almost picking nits to say that, but you know, they are not, you know, Duke peaked, I think, in the early 90s.
Well, you can Yeah, it's still been an incredible run during his tenure, and I suppose you could connect those dots in his case. I probably wouldn't, but I could see where people could and make a legitimate argument. I think there are other reasons why Duke has scuffled, in past years. But first of all, as Urban Meyer has found out, it's impossible to keep up those sort of runs. For what Krzyzewski and Duke did during that period was unprecedented, about, with the exception of UCLA. And here's Florida, who has won, three national championships in, the last 4 years?
Two in the last four,
Two in the last four.
Right.
I mean, we've covered this sport long enough to know how difficult it is to win a national championship, to get to a national championship, much less win two of these things in such a short period of time. So it's impossible to keep that up. And the pressure, especially at a place like Florida, where I do think that they're spoiled rotten, it wears on you. And it obviously had worn on Urban Meyer, and I wish him the best, and I hope he's making the right decision, and who am I to second guess it, but those quotes that you spoke of, regarding his daughters and how glad they were to see him step away, sort of remind me of the same sort of thing that you heard from the Krzyzewski family when that happened.
Yes.
And, to a lesser extent, someone like Bill Cowher, when he stepped away, and everybody needs to recharge, and maybe this time off for Urban Meyer, just sort of stepping back, and sort of, charging his batteries and getting his health back in order will be the difference. But again, you bring up these questions: how will it affect recruiting? How will it affect spring practice? There's that substitute teacher factor.
Yes.
When Urban Meyer is not there, when he's not hands on day to day, how will that affect them?
Who comes out early? I mean, it's been pretty well established that a lot of juniors have been planning to come out early, and I don't think that this will change that. But I don't know. It's clearly a story that will not end. Did not end yesterday. Will not end today, and is will be going on for weeks and months to come.
Well, the one other thing I've thought about this is how many other coaches in that business are thinking, what I wouldn't give to be able to walk away from my job, for a little while. I mean, if Urban Meyer's feeling this, I guarantee you other coaches are feeling it. Maybe not the exact same physical situation as Urban Meyer has, but they feel that stress. I mean, it is. It's an unrelenting, merciless job.
They earn their money.
They earn a lot of money. There's no doubt about it, obscene amounts of money. But it's an obscene amount of stress and pressure, and that they willingly take on. But we've seen now exactly what can happen to a guy when it overpowers you.
Gino, the holidays are over. Let the holidays begin. The bowls are getting bigger and bigger this week. We get the BCS Bowl starting this week. We get the Rose Bowl. We get the Sugar Bowl. We get the Orange and Fiesta, and next week the championship game.
Wait a second.
Yes.
I thought you said they're getting bigger and better.
Yeah, I know.
You're talking about the Orange Bowl.
Well, I actually like the Orange Bowl, but before we get to how I like it and you look down upon it, let's talk about the Rose Bowl, which, of course, Friday night, January 1st, ABC, 8 o'clock Eastern. You couldn't pick any two styles of everything more different than Oregon and Ohio State.
What are you suggesting there? Are you suggesting there's like a huge difference in sort of the way they play and the sort of the way they conduct themselves and sweater vest versus the fluorescent green and all that sort of thing? I mean, I hope you're not suggesting that.
And go on down the line. Look at the quarterbacks. You've got a guy who was largely unrecruited versus a five-star recruit, and yet the guy who attracted not a lot of attention has become one of the best quarterbacks in the country.
Yeah, Masoli.
Jeremiah Masoli. at Oregon, and then Terrell Pryor, who is a work in progress. He's a sophomore, and he's still learning, and he's still growing, and there still seems to be questions about what he can do in a big game against a tough defense.
So you know what, Ivan? When I look at Pryor, and this is no disrespect to Ohio State, but he seems like he would fit better in the offense that Oregon runs than sort of the way that Ohio State has tried to reconfigure its offense to sort of fit Pryor. I think Pryor really would have flourished in an offense like Oregon's, and they're trying at Ohio State. They're trying to fit him in and trying to make things work for him. But you bring up a great point. It seems like Pryor would fit better at Oregon than Masoli would fit better at Ohio State.
Well, my memory is that Oregon was one of his finalists. I mean, that he was intrigued by that offense and with Chip Kelly, but it was just too far away for a Pennsylvania kid to go. So he's at Ohio State, and I think somebody made a good comparison for me that kind of put Pryor into perspective, and it was simply that let's remember what Vince Young did his first two seasons at Texas. He said all anybody thinks about are his last two seasons at Texas. So if you can put it in that, in those terms, I think we, maybe we all need to see a bigger picture. But
yeah, well, and that's fair. The things that concern me about Pryor, 55.8% completion percentage is not great. That always has concerned me. His accuracy has been a problem, but he's their leading rusher. He is, like you said, a young quarterback, still sort of establishing himself. But you talk about differences between these teams, and it's almost comical, the stark differences. I mean, here you have Oregon that scores a lot, runs a lot, passes a lot, does everything really well on the offensive end of the ball. And then you have Ohio State, which gives up 12.2 points a game and here's to me the really interesting sort of matchup of the game. Ohio State has not had an opponent rush for a single rusher opponent rush for 100 yards. I'm going to spit this out somehow.
Yes.
Rush
we'll
for 100 yards
later.
Against them. And here you have Oregon, which they have it all on the offensive end of the ball. And you have Blunt back, who's getting more carries these days. You got LaMichael James, who replaced Blunt after the Boise State incident and who's gained almost 1,500 yards. So that's one of the things I'm going to look at this game.
I think the other point that to me is intriguing is style of play. We know what trestle ball is. It's old school football, field position, kicking game.
Yeah.
Get ahead and make the other team try to chase and catch you, when you're keeping the ball and making them go the whole field. Oregon, on the other hand, scores in a hurry, scores early, scores often, scores from anywhere, and its defense is used to spending more time on the field. So I'm not sure that Ohio State's, game plan for what it does traditionally would bother Oregon in the least.
Well, and Oregon's not going to go away. And just in case Ohio State needs proof of that, they can call Mike Stoops at Arizona, and he can tell you all about how Oregon won't go away. So if Ohio State thinks it's going to sort of distance themselves and then just, their defense will do the rest, I don't think that's going to be the case. Oregon is a resilient, resilient team. And we've talked about it during the course of the season on our podcast. What they overcame after that Boise State fiasco with Blunt and the loss at Boise State. They've won 10 of their last 11. And again, you can turn it around and say Ohio State also has overcome some things this year. And now they're in their fifth. Well, they won 5 games to end the season. They didn't look like they were going to go to a BCS bowl game there during points of the Big Ten season. And they turned it around, and here they are in their fifth consecutive BCS bowl game. So you've got to give Ohio State credit for also sort of turning around their season.
Well, they did, and did it with a great run, you know, sort of under the radar, to
Absolutely.
Coin a phrase. Have you ever heard that, under the radar?
Is that yours?
Yeah, I came up with that.
Uh-huh.
All the focus was on Iowa all season, and all of a sudden, Ohio State goes to Penn State and wins convincingly, and then beats Iowa in a great game and is in the Rose Bowl. I think it's going to be a great show. You can't beat, you know, you and I have spent many a January 1st in the Arroyo Seco. It's just it's a magical place, and I'm really looking forward to it. Next Monday, a week from today, tonight, on Fox, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, Boise State and TCU.
I'll be there.
Well, I think you got a great game. And the whole argument that these two teams, you know, were put together in some sort of conspiracy, and that for that reason this game should be looked down upon is just ridiculous. I think it's a great game. I think they're there because they are two very good teams and should be playing one another.
They're 25-0, combined 25-0.
That's pretty good.
I'll take that, and I don't care how it came about that they ended up playing. I love that they're playing. I think it's a great matchup for the Fiesta Bowl, and I don't care that they played last year.
Nope.
TCU won 17-16, but, you know, they're different years, different teams, a lot of the same players, but still different kind of teams, I think, in a way. And, you know, it's in reading some of the pregame stuff from some of these players, I don't quite know where TCU's head is right now. Some of the players, you read their comments, and you're not sure if they're taking Boise State seriously. Like, they're disappointed that they have to play Boise State, that they wanted to play, you know, one of the so-called big boys. But, hello, Boise State is one of the big boys.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And then you have Gary Patterson, the coach of TCU, and you can see what he's trying to do. He's saying, hey, look, fellas, we still have an outside chance, depending on how it goes in that BCS championship, of maybe winning the Associated Press National Championship, because they're two separate things. And he's trying to get these guys refocused on Boise State. I think that's a smart play. I don't know if...
You know what, Gino? I think the AP voters would look for a reason to vote for TCU if it presented itself. And the only reason I say that is because I thought that the comfortable margin by which the same voters picked Ndamukong Suh as the National Player of the Year, mm-hmm. you know, said to me, hey, let's make a splash. Let's show that we're not, you know, we're not beholden to anything in terms of reputation. We're going to go strictly by what we see. You know, I think they're looking for a reason if Alabama and Texas lay an egg.
Well, yeah, if that's a close game and it's not a very well-played game in the BCS championship, and then TCU, you know, does a dance in Boise State, you're right. I could see a lot of those guys, a lot of those voters saying, you know what? What the heck?
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's Monday night. Tuesday night of next week, the Orange Bowl, Iowa, Georgia Tech. This is a game that I seem to be the only one outside of Metropolitan Atlanta and Iowa to like.
Metropolitan Iowa. You know what? That's probably Metropolitan Iowa.
Did I say Metropolitan sense? Iowa? I thought it was.
Yeah, but you know what? You're that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
The whole state, well, except the Iowa State part, are crazy about the Hawkeyes.
And, you know, to me, it's a great matchup of a disciplined offense and what Georgia Tech does against a vanilla, very difficult defense that Iowa plays. You know, it's not fancy. They don't do a lot of blitzing. They just line up and say, okay, come, you execute and you beat us. And to me, I'm fascinated by it. I think it's going to be fun to watch.
Well, the fact that you're fascinated by it speaks volumes about
me,
about you. It's rather sad.
Yes.
You don't mind me saying. Now, you know what? I beat up on the Orange Bowl a little bit on this matchup, but if you just want to watch, you know, sort of a inside football kind of game, it will be neat because Iowa's defense, especially the interior of that defense, the line, the defensive line, inside linebackers. I mean, they're not fancy. They run this, you know, basic defense, but they don't screw up. They don't make a lot of mistakes. And even though I can't think of one offhand, I don't think anybody in the Big Ten runs a spread option I mean, practically nobody runs a spread option like Georgia Tech does.
Well, nobody anywhere runs
But if you had to pick a team that doesn't see that kind of offense on a regular basis, but it's going to be able to adapt to it, I would say it's Iowa. Plus the fact that you have as much time between the end of your regular season, especially in the Big Ten, to a bowl game is going to give Iowa a chance to really sort of figure it out a little more.
Plus the timing of Georgia Tech. You know, they were the timing of running that offense, I think, suffers more there than say, at other schools. And maybe I'm just reacting to that wonderful performance in the Chick-fil-A Bowl last year.
Yeah, well,
against LSU.
Yeah, and look, Georgia Tech's defense is so-so. Iowa's getting back quarterback Ricky Stanzi, though. Stanzi, if you count the days, it's been almost 60 days, you know, between when he injured his ankle against Northwestern and when he'll play in this bowl game. That's a long, long time. If you're talking about timing, that's going to be a really interesting thing to see how Stanzi responds to that. But he's been practicing the last 3 weeks. He says he's been practicing at 100%. So,
well, I'm going to predict. I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that Stanzi will have a slow first half and struggle.
Yeah, okay.
And then in the fourth quarter, and of course that's what he's done all year.
Yeah,
so,
well, that's what I was done all year. You're right.
Which gets us to the big one, Gino. January 7th, Texas and Alabama, 26-0 combined. Two great traditions, two teams that rarely play, and Texas wins when they do play. And yet Alabama is a huge favorite.
Huge? What is it, like 7 or something like that, 7.5?
You know, I don't know what the point spread is, and I've seen it fluctuate a little bit, move slowly toward Alabama, but when I say huge favorite, I say I struggle to find anybody who thinks Texas is going to win.
Well, the danger is to base everything off of the Big 12 championship game, which I'm sure a lot of people are, and basing a lot of what Alabama did in the SEC championship game. You know, we've seen it time and time again. You don't know what these layoffs do to these teams.
Yes.
Does it take the edge off of Alabama? Does it give Texas time to regroup? But I think what you're talking about are some of the basics. Texas still doesn't have a running game. And Nebraska exposed even more things about Texas than we'd like to see. Texas has been up and down. I mean, you go back to what that offense did against A&M and then what it did against Nebraska. Alabama has been less up and down, but they've had their moments where you're not quite sure what you're seeing. But I like Alabama's consistency. I like their running game. You know, I think you win these games with the running game and a strong defense, and Alabama has both of those things, whereas Texas, I think you could only argue, has one of those, and that's a pretty consistently strong defense.
Well, they both have good kickers. They both have good kicking games. Alabama's got a very good return game. They both have coaches who will know how to handle this kind of week and this kind of game. When I look at Texas, I see a team that struggled mightily against the two best defenses it played in Oklahoma and Nebraska. I heard somebody point out the other day that if you look at Jeff Sagarin's computer rankings in USA Today, that Alabama is 7-0 against his top 30. Texas is 2-0. So, to me, I just feel that, you know, Alabama comes into the game having proven more, having been, as you said, been more steady. I think, you know, you get in the danger of Texas, you know, nobody thinking Texas has a chance to win, much like 4 years ago when they went to the Rose Bowl and we were all ready to crown USC as the greatest team ever to play college football.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you give Saban this much time, and I'm not saying Mack Brown isn't a great coach. His record certainly speaks to greatness. But Saban is a defensive coach specialist. I mean, this is what he lives for. I mean, you know him as well as just about anybody. And, you know, I'm sure he's, like, drawing on Christmas napkins,
yes,
you know, what he's going to try to do. I think he's going to make Colt McCoy have to beat them single-handedly. And or take away Colt McCoy and make somebody else beat him. And whatever he decides to do, I think it's going to be difficult for Texas to pull it off. I just don't see the running game to take the pressure off of McCoy. And we saw what happened with Nebraska against Texas. McCoy couldn't do it all by himself. He tried, but he couldn't do it by himself. He threw three interceptions. He almost lost the game with that pass out of bounds. I think it's going to be tough, very tough for Texas to win this thing.
Yeah, and not that Terrence Cody is a different kind of presence in the middle of the line than Ndamukong Suh is, but you know Alabama is so strong up the middle, and Cody is more of a clogger, a guy who clogs up the line than he is a guy that goes after the quarterback the way Suh did. But to me, that parallel, Alabama being so strong and up front defensively and the Texas offensive line clearly having problems, when you give up 9 sacks to anybody.
Yeah. Well, Suh was, that was a once-in-a-decade kind of,
absolutely.
Honest to goodness, Ivan, and we've both been doing this, longer than we'd like to admit, I have never seen a defensive lineman have that kind of game before.
No.
Never.
I agree.
So is Bama going to be able to, have that same sort of performance? I doubt it. I don't think anybody could. But I think it showed that Texas's offensive line definitely has some problems and can be, and those problems were exposed. And I think Alabama will do whatever it has to do to take advantage of those weaknesses.
Which, and Texas, in their defense, and Greg Davis has been, again, the offensive coordinator at Texas for a very long time, and he's proven his capability in the quarterbacks that he's turned out. And their response is, our running game is that swing pass, into the flat. That's our running game. That gets us to 2nd and 5, 2nd and 4. It serves the same purpose.
It does and it doesn't, though. It does from the standpoint, it gets us to a 2nd and 5, but it doesn't from the standpoint of maybe wearing somebody else down a little more, wearing them up more down on a physical standpoint where you're just, firing out and sort of imposing your will. And I know it sounds, kind of a cliche, but it really does factor into a game. And it does, to me, football, without getting all, Lombardi here, it's all about imposing wills. And if you can't run the ball and the other team can, I think that wears on you after a while.
And Alabama, what did they do in one important game after the other is they won the fourth quarter. I think the only fourth quarter where they really struggled was against your guys, against Tennessee. And even then, it was only just a 3-minute meltdown.
Right.
That said, Texas 7-0-1 historically against Alabama. That of course doesn't mean anything next week, but it's just one of those little things that's fun to notice. The other thing is that the last 4 times they've played, which covers a 50-year period, Texas has been the lower-ranked bowl in every game, and those games were 3-0-1 in favor of Texas. So.
Yeah, and they're going to be motivated, motivation's a huge thing come bowl season. I mean, we've seen teams get invites and just get there and have nothing, and then we've seen other teams.
Even in the championship game, we've seen that, which is odd, but it's true.
Look at Notre Dame. They didn't even want to bother with a bowl this year. There are reasons for that, and I'm sure some that were never spoken. For example, I happen to think Jimmy Clausen probably wasn't at all excited. Why would he want to risk his upcoming NFL career on the, lower tier bowl that Notre Dame was going to play in?
On a bad foot that he's played on all year.
That he's trying to get healthy for, combines and pro days and things like that. So there are all sorts of reasons why teams get jacked up or not for a bowl game. And the main thing that always you just can't figure out, and I'm sure coaches are terrified of, is that long, long layoff, especially from teams that are playing in the BCS bowls.
Well, you and I have weathered that long layoff well. We were on our game today, I think, Gino.
I think so.
Yes.
All right, Happy New Year, my friend.
You too. That's it for the ESPNU College Football Podcast. Thanks for downloading us.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNradio.com. Hey, college football fans, this podcast is brought to you by Citi. And whether it's football or finance, teamwork matters, which is why Citi is proud to present the 2010 Citi BCS National Championship Game.